Okay, let's start talking about the ring. For those that haven't don't have familiarity with it, we'll save the praise and effusive lauding of it until later. But it's important to understand the story of it. And maybe perhaps before we get to the story, we should talk about the way in which Wagner wrote it. Of course, it's based upon a Nordic myth, the Germanic version, the Nibelungen line that Wagner drew from freely. He didn't follow it faithfully, but he used it for his own purposes. There's basically four periods in Wagner's writing of opera. The first period, he follows the basic opera tradition of the time, especially the Parisian tradition. He writes a number of operas, and he eventually tries to get them performed in Paris. Meyerbeer, the Jewish composer, Meyerbeer is the big name of the time, whose operas are seldomly performed today. But Wagner's operas didn't do well. His last opera, which is still sometimes performed today, Rienzi, was what he thought was going to be the big hit. But after it didn't do well, Wagner, out of a sense of personal anguish, but also motivated by something at even a deeper level, rejected that whole view of opera that was basically bourgeois, middle class, for the businessman, for the people that wanted to be seen in society. The operas of the time in Paris almost always had ballets, almost always were oriented toward the aria, the singer, the set pieces. And so Wagner rejected that. He had a theory that we'll talk about perhaps on another occasion, of what opera should be. In fact, Wagner didn't like the word opera. He used an English translation of the word music drama, which we'll probably talk about later as well. And he begins the first period of his fruitful opera composition with Flying Dutchman, and then after that comes Tannhäuser, and then finally his most popular opera, at least the most performed opera, is Lohengrin. And then he takes about a 6-year hiatus and writes no opera. It's his only time in life that he doesn't write much of anything. And he begins to write a series of books and essays about the nature of opera, the future of music, and sets a theory of what he's going to do later in his life, and actually, amazingly, accomplishes it. Now, Wagner's writing is often convoluted, tedious, florid, very effusive in its use of language, and yet if you stick with it, it often pays back, because he has some great insights in it. And he actually begins to accomplish what he sets forth in practice in his theoretical writings. And of course he begins by one of his theses, and that is that opera should be drawn from myths, because myths deal with what is universal in human nature and in human experience, and abstracts from it all of the unnecessary particularities. Not just of this or that particular human being, but this or that particular type of event and situation and, let's say, characteristic human human interaction with the world. Myths deal with that which is, for lack of a better word, which is most primal. And so Wagner begins to draw on the the Norse mythology, as I said before, the Nibelungenlied. And he does it quite liberally. He doesn't follow it rigorously, but he draws inspiration from it. And so he begins writing, as some of you may not know, Wagner writes his own libretti, which is not the norm for most of the great opera writers. Of course, Mozart and even Beethoven only wrote one opera, but Strauss, Verdi, none of them wrote their own libretti, but Wagner does. And he begins by writing about what is originally called Siegfried's death. Siegfried is, of course, a hero in Nordic Germanic mythology. And so he writes about his death, and he then comes to realize it needs to have some backfilling. And so he goes on to talk about the young Siegfried. And so that is the first one. Siegfried's death was originally called Siegfried's Tod in German, and that eventually becomes Götterdämmerung, the twilight of, or the evening of the gods, or the non-literally, but the ending of the gods. And then the one about the young Siegfried becomes simply Siegfried. And then he goes on to write the backstory of that and fills it, and he calls it the Valkyrie. And in German it's Die Walküre, and it's not the article that's in the singular, which it could be. It's not just the feminine singular article. I mean, it's not the plural article. It's not the Valkyries, but it's the Walküre. It's a particular one, and it's basically Brunhilde. It's about Brunhilde. And then after he finishes that one, he goes back more and gives the pre-story to that one. And that is, he never considers it part of the ring proper, but he calls it the preliminary evening, the Vorabend, and that is Rheingold. And so he writes four music dramas, or as we would call them today, what we call them traditionally operas, and he kind of by accident, he doesn't set out to write four operas, but he keeps on moving through one after another, and so he writes them backwards. He starts with the ending, and he goes on to, finally, Rheingold, and writes the beginning of it. And so we have four operas that he intended, after he completed them, to be performed in 1 week. And they're sometimes performed like that way today, but sometimes they're performed singly or over a course of a season, but to get the full impact, you really do, I mean, Wagner's insights are almost always correct. You really have to see him in a single week. And so you start with Rheingold, and where he ended is where we begin, and that is a story of the beginnings of things. Now, I mean, to give you a little more backstory, the way he composes the music is the opposite order. He begins scoring Rheingold first, and he doesn't compose the music to the last one first, got the demo wrong, but Rheingold, and it's obvious that he doesn't do it if you are familiar with the operas, because a lot of the themes in the first one come through throughout all the operas, all the way to the ending. In fact, the one of the grand themes in the first opera, in Act 2, is one of the climactic themes that ends the opera in the final act of the last opera. So anyways, Wagner begins to write the music of Rheingold, and then he writes the music for Die Walküre, and then my memory is a little fuzzy here, but I think he gets through the second act of Siegfried, the third opera, and he stops. And he writes, at this time, two other great operas, Tristan and Isolde, and then Die Meistersinger. And at the end of, between the end of Act 2 of Siegfried, from the beginning in Rheingold, that's considered his middle period of writing. And when he takes this hiatus and writes Tristan, and then Meistersinger. From the beginning of Tristan, that's considered his third period. So he writes Tristan, he writes composes Meistersinger, and then after that, he comes back to Siegfried and completes it, the last act, and then moves to Götterdämmerung, and then his final opera is Parsifal. And maybe on another occasion we'll have a chance to talk about all these operas, but kind of culminate in Parsifal. But he writes The Ring from the libretto to the music over a period of 27 years. And so this is a work of opera that Mozart writes Don Giovanni, I believe it was in 3 weeks. He writes the music, of course. He has a librettist, but he writes the music in something like 3 weeks, which is miraculous. But Wagner takes 27 years to write The Ring from beginning to end, and it encompasses two of his great creative periods. Anyway, that's a little story about how he wrote it. But now let's talk about the operas themselves. We'll start with Rheingold. We'll work backwards from the way in which he wrote them, but we'll work the correct way from which we hear the operas and see them if they're performed in the way that he intended to have them performed, with the progression of the four from Rheingold to Götterdämmerung. Now, Rheingold is the basic myth in which all the opera is set. And it's the most mythic, if you will, of all the four operas. It's the one that discusses the primordial issues of creation, of life, of the different realms, the different beings. And it is the world which exists before human beings enter it, at least before they enter it in any important way. And so Rheingold begins, we won't talk about the music unless we'll take some asides here and there, but Rheingold begins with the three Rhine maidens that are dancing in the Rhine River, the pure river, which of course is a real river in Germany, but it's also a mythical, it takes place in mythical space and mythical time. And these three river nymphs are the daughters of the Rhine River himself. And they have a great treasure called the Rheingold, which is a piece of gold, basically, in the midst of the Rhine River, that at certain periods, certain times of the day, the sun hits it, and it becomes something that creates a particularly beautiful environment within the river, and the river nymphs, river goddesses, glory in its beauty, its radiance, and they enjoy it not for the gold itself. They have no desire for the gold, for the wealth that it stands for. They have no desire for the power that the wealth can bring them. They simply love the gold for its the beauty that it creates at a certain time of the day, as it interacts with other things in its environment. The sun, the dancing of the waves as it laps on the shore. And so they love the gold for its for what it is, for its beauty. And so they are actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. They are the river nymphs come before the Rheingold actually comes into the picture. The river nymphs are frolicking in the midst of the Rhine, carefree. They are free spirits. They are somewhat they're akin to the Greek mythology the sirens. They are seductresses, but nevertheless they are free spirited. River goddesses that inhabit the river and are enjoying frolicking in the primal environment that has been given them. And then into the in the, from the depths comes the dwarf, the dwarf Elbrecht. And Elbrecht sees the nymphs as objects of desire. And this is basically sexual desire. He desires to be with them. And so he attempts to seduce them seriatim, one after another. And so the Rhine maidens play along with him, and one after another coyly play with him, try to arouse him, and then one after another they reject him. And it's as if it's like a relay race. They pass the baton one after another and say, go to the next one, go to the next one. And finally at the end, when the last one rejects him for his ugliness, for his warts, for his swarthiness, for his very bodily essence, he sneezes, it's very, very earthly kind of being. He curses them. He curses the nymphs for that. And then about the time that he is uttering these curses, the Rhine gold is illuminated by the sun. And the nymphs quickly turn from their attention from him, which is a diversion, to that which is transcendent, that which is beautiful, and that which is mysterious, that which is beyond normal experience. And they glory in the radiance of the Rheingold. And Albrecht, who is the earthly one, is not impressed by it. It's not something, he has no, what we'd say, cult today, or for the uppity, an aesthetic sense. He's interested in procuring his procuring that those objects which will satisfy his lust. He's not interested in the what you could call the aesthetic experience. But in the process of him querying the Rhine maiden, they tell him that, well, this isn't just an object of beauty. This is something that is potentially the world's most powerful object, because the being, if there's a being who would willing to do this, which they don't theoretically believe there is, and certainly not of Albrecht, but if somebody renounces love and takes the gold for themselves, they can fashion a ring, and this ring will become an object that can bring the whole world under its control. Now, you got to understand the nature of mythology here. And to the modern mind, this sounds a little hokey. It's some silly device to get the plot moving. But you got to understand what's going on here. It's basically taking something and making it into something that we all know at a primal level is the case, that you can take anything that is good, and I don't. And this is going to be somewhat of a banal explanation, but there's much more levels to this. But you can take anything that's good and pervert it. You can take anything for its that it stands on its own, and then take it and turn it into something and use it for something that it was not meant to. And so the ring is, the gold is something that exists, and it's to them simply what Albrecht would be considered a toy, and what Wotan considers to them a toy. But it's to them, it's something that is of most, of utter value to them, and yet it's not something that they possess. It's not something to be used for some other end. But Albrecht, when he hears what can be done with it, then turns his lust, or redirects his lust, away from the Rhine maidens to the lust for power. And what Wagner is telling us here is it's the same lust. The lust for conquest of the woman, the lust for conquest of the world. Albrecht didn't love woman in the same way as other characters of the Ring love woman. Albrecht loved woman as simply a means of gratifying certain desires, and that can be easily transferred into gratifying a desire or a desire for power. So that's what Albrecht does. He hears what the ring, the gold can be transformed into, and he switches his affections from the Rhine maidens to the ring. And so he does what the Rhine maidens say that, or at least really believe that nobody's going to would do, and that is, he renounces love. And again, only those that the one that renounces love can take the gold and fashion it into this ring. And so Albrecht curses love. He renounces it. He gives it up forever. That's the price he pays for gaining the power. And so he makes a decision, and the decision is that he was willing to renounce that which is most precious to human beings, most precious to us, and he decides to go after something of less value. And yet, many people, in fact, this is the history of the world in a sense, make the mistake of, and that is transferring your primary desire to that which, from love to conquest, to power, to dominion. And so he chooses dominion. And so he renounces love, he curses love, and he grabs the gold, and off he goes with it. And so that begins the opera. This is the first scene. The Rheingold is an opera in one act. There's four scenes, but it's just one act. Wagner never wants the curtain to fall in the first evening. And so the first act begins with a primordial situation in which it's an age of innocence. Now, this isn't quite a Christian myth, of course, because it's an age of, not righteousness, but an age of innocence. It's an age of not knowing, in a sense, good or evil. Wagner is an artist in the old sense of the word, and to him, art is the end of all things. And so, in the innocent stage, things are loved for their, not their goodness, but their beauty, for their radiance, for their glory. And to him, in a sense, to be beautiful is to be good. And so that's the age in which it begins. It's a primal age, an age in which there is not an establishment of good, not an order of evil. It's really neither good nor evil. It's just an age in which there is raw beauty in the world, raw primal forces going on, and the river nymphs are in tune with those things. I mean, certainly, if you were to talk about their character from a moral point of view, they are seductresses. They do tease him. In fact, at one point they said, you know, he was all Albrecht's affections switched from one to another. And they chastened him at the end by saying, you know, if you had stayed true to one of us, then we would have been yours. But you were fickle. And so these are somewhat amoral beings. But to Wagner, the primordial universe is not something that is moral. It's something that has a different basis to it, and that is an aesthetic basis. Anyways, the Albrecht curses love and grabs the gold. And the next scene is something, people would say, completely different. We go from the depths of the Rhine under the river to the heights of the mountains, and you have the gods now, the introduction of the gods. Albrecht is a dwarf, and I guess we should say things here. There's a lot, it's a bit complex, but once you understand it, not really that difficult. But there are three basic orders. There's the order of the gods, there's the order of the giants, the Risen, and then there's the order of the dwarfs. Albrecht is a dwarf. The gods are introduced in the second scene, and Wotan, or Odin in the Norse mythology, is the king of the gods, and he is in a state of slumber, dreaming. And he's awakened by his wife, Fricka, who is a typical wife in many senses of the word. Wotan loves Fricka in a certain sense, but not in all senses, but Fricka awakens him from his dreams, and he's dreaming about, like many men would dream, about power and conquest, but Wotan is not like an Albrecht in that he is simply interested in power and conquest. Wotan is interested in love, but we'll get to that later. So he's dreaming about this great fortress that is being built for him, and how he will firmly establish his dominion over all the world once this fortress is firmly established. And so Fricka awakens him from a slumber. And he looks, and in the distance, after he wakes up, he sees the fortress finally completed. And that is, of course, called Valhalla. This is the great fortress of the gods in the Norse mythology. And so Wotan is awakened and sees that this fortress is completed. Now, who completed it will come in just a moment. But it's completed. And he believes that his dominion, his authority over the world, has now been firmly fixed. But of course, things are never simple, right? This is drama. And so you have to have complexities added in, just like our human experience. And so the complexity here is that the fortress is built by the giants, the third group of beings. Remember, there's the dwarfs, the giants, and the gods. And these giants are immensely powerful beings, but they're oafish and slow, and can be outfoxed by either the gods or the dwarfs, and yet, in a sense, they're more powerful, primally, than the other ones. They're the ones that built Valhalla, and the reason they built it is because Wotan entered into a deal with them. And the contract was that they would build this immense fortress, that embodied his power and would establish his vast control over the entire world, for a price. And their price was the sister of Fricka, Freya. Freya is the goddess of life. She's the goddess of the harvest, of new beginnings. She is the one that grows in her garden golden apples that the gods partake of, that gives them their immortality. And the giants' demand is their price for this great labor, that the gods hand over Fricka. Now Wotan agreed
Freya.
To this. I'm sorry, Freya. Now Wotan had agreed to this. Now after he's awakened from a slumber in his dream, Fricka, the practical one, reminds him of this contract. Now Wotan is one who is always searching and always longing for that which never was, and always for the possibilities. And Fricka is his wife who brings him back down to reality and to the mundane details. And so she reminds him that, look, this is what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to give up Freya in order to do this. And after some conversation, he likes to toy with his wife, but he eventually tells her that, no, I have no intention of giving those oafs Freya. Now the elves come, the giants come, and they demand payment. And so Votan is playing a delaying game with them, because the reason he entered into the agreement, at least on a surface level, there's a deeper level that we'll get to later. Well, the surface level is that a demigod called Loga, the god in Norse mythology of trickery, of fire, of changeability, mutability, he is the a being that Votan befriended. The other gods do not like, but Votan, who is, to speak in a prosaic way, more open-minded than the other gods, he befriends Loga. And Loga assures him, or at least gives him some assurance, that he can enter into that, he being Votan, enter into a deal with the giants, and that to build the fortress, and he would get him out of his end of the bargain. He wouldn't have to give up Freya. And so Votan is delaying with the giants when they come and saying, no, you couldn't possibly mean that. And of course they say, yes, we did mean that, and that's your deal. Now, one of the giants, I think it's Fasolt, but it may be the other one, Fafnir. I think it's Fasolt. Fasolt tells him that, you know, not only did they mean it, but Votan is bound to his word because the contract that they have is written upon his spear. Now, a spear is his symbol of authority, but his authority is based upon covenant. It's based upon agreement.
Exactly.
And so, he does rule the world, but he rules by organizing all the different races in terms of mutual agreements with one another.
Exactly.
And so they said that his authority will be destroyed if he doesn't follow through on his agreements. Now, Votan is beginning to be pressed here, and he's looking for certain ways. You know, he tries all kinds of sophistries with the giants. You know, what could you possibly want of a goddess? I mean, what are you going to do with them? In other words, Fasolt at this time has a beautiful line. And introduces one of the beautiful motifs of the work, saying that he may not have the wisdom of the gods, but he loves Freya, he loves her, and he doesn't see what the gods who would be willing to deal with her, what they see in her, and so actually in the argument of Votan and the giants, the Doma giants, the stupid giants, had the better of Votan in it. But Votan is delaying, and so he's delaying because he wants Loga to come and rescue him. And so in the meantime, before Loga comes, other gods are entered, and they don't play a great role in it, but their parts are they're beautiful in their way, and the god Donner, or in the Norse mythology, the equivalent of Thor, comes in. And then the other god, remind me who the other god was. Fro, Joy. So he comes in. So two other, these are all brothers, Fricka and Freya. They come in and they're both willing to fight the giants and destroy them. I think it's Donner says, I fought many giants before and killed many of them. In fact, Fasolt and Fafnir are the last of the race of the giants. And Votan realizes that, no, we can't do it, settle it this way, because this would break covenant. And the gods' reign would be destroyed. Votan as a representative god. And so he cools the heat of the other gods and realizes that he is really in a pickle. He really has to have some way out of it other than violence. He just can't destroy the giants by violence without destroying his own reign. And so Loga eventually comes, and Wagner is the master. You know, there's many deep things about Wagner. He's also just the master of drama. He draws this out, and then finally Loga comes in. And Loga, in one of the steam sealing episodes in The Ring, comes in and basically plays with everybody. He plays with Fricka. He plays with Freya. He plays with Donner and Fro. He plays with the giants. He even plays with Votan. Telling everybody, as a Greek chorus, what the real desires are. I mean, Loga sees through everybody. He is the one who understands everybody. But he also is the spokesman for the world, in a sense, or particularly for the Rhine Maiden. And so he comes in and says that, look, this is hopeless, Votan. The giants aren't going to give up Freya, because only those that would give up on love, the love of woman, would do that. And he tells a story about he travels the world. And no man is willing to give that up. No man is willing. And of course, Votan understands that, because he's not willing to do that. And so the thing seems hopeless. Now, at this point, the other gods, especially Fricka, are beside themselves and have had enough of it. But Votan understands Loga at a very... he understands what Loga's about, and he's setting things up. And Votan understands that the longer he delays, the better his scheme is going to be. And so that's what actually Loga's doing. He has a long-delayed scheme, and the scheme is this, that nobody would give up woman for power. Nobody would give up the love of woman for anything. But we already know from Act 1 that somebody has done just that, don't we? And that, of course, is Albrecht. Somebody has done that. And so that's what he's setting it up to. But it's not just setting it up for purposes of plot, but nobody naturally would do that type of thing. Votan wouldn't do that. He never does that. Votan desires power, but he never is willing to renounce love. And so Votan is intrigued just like anybody else. Who would do this? Nobody would do this. And I should say, not really as an aside, but it's kind of a backfill, when he talks about the love of woman, introduces the, I'm sure the Wagner scholars have a label for it, but I'll call it the yearning theme. He introduces one of the great themes throughout the whole Ring cycle, that whenever there's talk later about the love of woman, and this is love of woman in a carnal sense, not in the evil sense of carnality, but in the physical sense, the love of man for woman, this theme is played throughout. And it's quite a beautiful theme. And nobody would give that up. Well, eventually, Loga comes out with it and says, well, there was somebody that has done this, and in doing so, they were able to create this ring of power. Now, here, as they say, the plot thickens, because as soon as Votan, especially, but others as well, hear about this ring of power, they're enchanted with this. It's almost as if all this other discussion is beside the point. They're all intrigued by this. But he tells this tale about Albrecht, who gives up the love for a woman, which, this sounds, if you're not careful, you're not going to understand this properly. As Christians, we think of love in many senses. Love for friends, love for the brethren, love for your wife, love for your family, love for the church, love of God is the highest. But to Wagner, love of woman is really the highest form of love. So you have to understand that. And it'd be for a Christian to give up love of God, which is a denial of the greatest of loves. Nobody is going to do this, but somebody has done this, and that is Albrecht. And so he tells about the what happened in scene one, where Albrecht did first love, renounce it, in order to obtain the world. Now this puts Albrecht, of course, naturally at odds with Wotan, apart from the issue of the ring, because Wotan is the ruler of the world, right? And now here comes somebody who has staked his claim to the whole world. And so already Wotan is going to be at enmity with Albrecht, who Wagner uses, as we'll talk about later as we get into this, Albrecht and Wotan are in some ways alter egos. Very similarly motivated in some senses, the same character in many ways, and yet very radically different in other ways. Anyways, here's this being that has renounced love in order to obtain power. In order to obtain power, in the way in which he's going to obtain power is precisely by renouncing love and by obtaining this ring. Now, Loga's plan is to say, look, you can solve this issue, Wotan, by getting the ring from this being, from Albrecht, giving it to the giants and paying them off. Now, Loga knows by the way he set it up, especially with giant Fafnir. Fafnir is immediately, as soon as it's almost as if, as soon as he hears the word ring, right, and in German it's the same word as in English, he's entranced by it, and he desires it more than Fricka. Fasold is a little bit different. And Fasold's character is very fascinating, very brief in the